Just over halfway through this year, and Baltimore has crossed a frightening threshold. More than 200 city residents have been murdered. What can be done to stop the violence? Daniel Webster, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research, discusses the obstacles posed by stolen guns and repeat offenders. And Erica Bridgeford, one of the organizers of a 72-hour ceasefire this coming weekend, explains how she is making a pitch for peace.
It's that real recognizes real kind of thing that happens when you take this message to the street, because they recognize that you want to have an authentic conversation with them about their own power to have peace in this city.
Stopping the killings, it's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. In 2015, Baltimore reached a violent milestone, 344 homicides, the vast majority by gun. It was the deadliest year since 1993, when the city saw nine more murders, but also had a bigger population, about 100,000 more residents. Last year, the murder rate was also above 300, and 7 months into this year, Baltimore already has surpassed 200 killings. Later, we'll speak with Erica Bridgeford, one of the organizers of Baltimore Ceasefire, which is calling for a 72-hour truce, a weekend without murders. But first, what policies can Baltimore adopt to stop the killings? Daniel Webster is director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research. He also leads the Johns Hopkins Baltimore Collaborative for Violence Reduction. Thanks for making time for us on the record.
Oh, I'm pleased to be here.
Many people may view gun violence as a criminal justice issue, a policing issue. You study it as a public health issue. Why?
Well, mainly because I think there are advantages to looking at it that way. I also want to be clear. While my academic base is in public health, and I'm sort of grew up, if you will, as a public health person, I recognize that to accomplish important public health and safety tasks, you need partnerships. Sometimes those partnerships are with law enforcement. So it's valuable to view violence as a public health problem, because we know so much about the etiology or roots of violence have to do with, things like exposure to lead. It has to do with behavioral norms. It has to do with the environment, neighborhood environment. There are so many conditions that sort of facilitate violence that also are connected to other health issues. Substance abuse, of course, is one very obvious issue of the link between health. And then there are at least some cases with respect to mental illness that also can be elevate risks for violence. So there are a lot of linkages to public health and violence. I guess one last point I'll say here is that particularly when you're looking at gun violence, what we've observed, and actually criminologists and epidemiologists have observed, is that it really operates like an infectious disease in many ways, and it's useful to understand it in that way and how you prevent the spread of gun violence, just as you would want to prevent the spread of the flu, for example.
In that context, I want to ask you about the bill that the Baltimore City Council is considering. It would impose a mandatory one-year sentence on those charged with a second handgun offense or someone charged carrying a gun in connection with another crime. I want to play a bit of Police Commissioner Kevin Davis's testimony from last Tuesday.
Let me make one thing clear to everyone. This isn't about mass incarceration or locking up more people. It's about holding the right people accountable and putting the right people in jail. This is anything but zero-tolerance policing, and I think I've demonstrated over the last couple of years that I am adamantly and publicly opposed to any and all things zero-tolerance policing. That's what got us in this predicament to begin with. In Baltimore, the right people are those who want to harm you, your daughter, your son, your neighbor, our community. There were 318 murders in 2016. 84% of those murders were committed by someone using a handgun.
And a different perspective from Daphne Austin, who lost her son to a gunshot.
And I don't believe in incarceration. I believe take the gun from them and melt the gun and throw it away. Just take the gun and get rid of the gun and get rid of the money. And I don't want no more pain coming from anybody. And I'm sure I'm speaking on behalf of the mothers. But we can no longer stay in this senseless violence.
What do you make of this bill? Are mandatory minimum sentences the answer?
I agree with Commissioner Davis that an important aspect of our problem with incredibly high homicide rates is illegal gun possession. And I also agree with Commissioner Davis that the vast majority of individuals who are arrested, particularly repeat offenders, they typically are incredibly high risk for involvement in serious gun violence. What this bill addresses is a sentencing component. Sentences are important. There needs to be some consequence for illegal behavior. Otherwise, it limits the deterrence of your law. And so I totally understand where Commissioner Davis is coming from. What's difficult as a researcher is that there's not a single study that really examines a comparable law where I could say this definitely will or will not reduce violence. But we know that particularly being arrested repeatedly with illegal gun possession is associated with incredibly high risk for shooting people and being shot.
How much of gun violence is committed by stolen or illegally possessed guns?
That's a great question. And even though I've spent most of my 25-year research career focusing on how criminals get guns, there's no really definitive data. The best data nationally suggests that about 10% of criminals say, yeah, I stole the gun that I used in a crime. But the big uncertainty is they also, more commonly, probably about 40% of the time, they get it sort of on the street. And are those street sources stealing them? Probably certainly some are. But it's very difficult to kind of trace the whole history of a gun. But stolen guns are important.
That's Danielle Webster, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about how to curb gun violence in Baltimore. And I guess that's really what I want to ask you. You mentioned quite a few factors a minute ago, but what are the most effective ways to reduce gun violence?
I think you certainly need to focus on illegal gun possession with both your policing, your prosecution, and consequences. But there also needs to be interventions that try to address the conflicts where guns then come into play. And so a program like Safe Streets is designed really specifically to help mediate conflicts, help individuals come to different ways to resolve their conflicts without shooting each other.
Let me just swoop in and remind people that Safe Streets is a violence interruption effort. It operates in McKeldry Park, Cherry Hill, Mondawmin, and Park Heights, I guess, for the last 10 years or so in at least some of
McKeldry
these neighborhoods.
McKeldry Park has had it for 10 years. Cherry Hill for about 8. The other ones not nearly as long.
And outreach workers who may have a history of street crime work with at-risk young people to prevent violence. The most recent estimate I've heard attributed to you is that this program reduced shootings by 27% compared to similar areas that did not have a Safe Streets hub.
Yeah, that's correct.
What makes it successful?
Again, it sort of comes down to looking at the nature of what are the immediate causes of gun violence. Of course, we know sort of root causes have to do with joblessness and other kinds of issues. But in the more immediate sense, many of them are simply conflicts. There are arguments, there's disagreements, and having individuals whose principal job is to help mediate those disputes and serve as role models. Like, you can be a man and not respond with violence when you're in a disagreement or someone disrespects you. It's really critically important.
If Baltimore invested more in safe streets, could it bring this homicide rate down?
I think it would make a difference. I don't want to pretend that it is the magical thing that will be completely transformative of the city. I do think, based upon my own research studying this for roughly a decade, that it certainly makes a difference. Fewer people get shot when safe street workers are working in neighborhoods than if they don't. I think, however, it has been run really sort of as demonstration projects. So as you mentioned, there are four neighborhoods where we have sites now. I think our challenge for our city right now is, how do you take an idea like safe streets and help expand that to a broader citywide initiative? But the other important thing, and this is something that Baltimore Police is making great progress in, is that they're closing more of their cases when there are shootings and homicides than was the case in 2016. We still need to do a lot better, because when murders or shootings are not solved with an arrest and a prosecution, then you have street justice. And again, you have this spiraling kind of effect. And I think that's what propelled us in 2015 to those historic high rates of murders. And so I think when we talk about policing in the city, a lot of times the focus is, what do residents see? Do they see people on patrol in their neighborhoods and that sort of makes them feel safe? Patrol is an important component. But I think my own sense is, solving crimes, particularly the most violent ones, is really so critical. And it's an incredibly challenging thing. What our detectives do with the very scant amount of resources is almost miraculous, honestly.
Right, but there's a lot of discussion by police, by Commissioner Davis, as well as others, as to the police need tips, the police need cooperation from people in the community who, from what I hear, are not often willing to do that.
Well, that's definitely the case. I served as director of Baltimore's Homicide Review Commission in 2015 and got to review a lot of cases, talked to a lot of detectives and community members and people affected. And that is clearly a huge impediment to resolving these cases. When I was talking about return on investment, one such investment could be witness protection. One reason people don't come forward with information to police is they're scared for their lives. So what I understand, talking to state prosecutors here, they do their best, but they have very minimal resources to really invest in protecting witnesses and people who are going to testify. So I think our city loses so much in so many ways. We talk about lives, but it really hurts us economically as well. And so I think that there could be really smart investment in ways to protect witnesses, enhance trust between police and community. In the challenging circumstances that we find ourselves in today, of people being more reluctant to come forward, and honestly also juries being very skeptical. I'm told by at least some prosecutors that it's very hard to convince juries unless you have video footage or something that's, you know, shows the defendant in the act. You know, my sense, I think there should be some real careful thought about, could we be investing more in cameras, for example, and other kind of technology to help us really have a greater likelihood that if someone is committing a violent act, at least on a street, in a open public place, that there are enough security cameras around that they may be viewed and therefore much more likely to be brought to justice.
I appreciate you walking us through it. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Daniel Webster is director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research. He also leads the Johns Hopkins Baltimore Collaborative for Violence Reduction. We'll link to some of his research at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cast. After a quick break on the record, the group Baltimore Ceasefire is calling for 72 hours without murders this weekend. We speak to one of the movement's organizers about how gun violence has affected her life. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Nobody kill anybody. That's the plea of organizers with Baltimore Ceasefire. They're asking for a 72-hour truce Friday to Sunday and inviting city residents to participate in community events such as a peace rally and a vigil for victims of homicide. Joining me to talk about this call for nonviolence is Baltimore Ceasefire organizer Erica Bridgeford. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you for having me.
Erica, when you present this idea to people who are caught up in street violence, perhaps involved in gangs or in the drug trade, what is your pitch?
It's the same pitch that we give to anybody else. We start with, hey, have you heard about the Baltimore ceasefire? And then we explain that it is asking for a personal commitment to peace, to telling people you are connected with to make that commitment. And the kind of responses that we get are, some, you know, I'm not sure that that's going to work, people say, but we go, okay, are you saying that you can't keep this neighborhood safe? You know, can't you make sure this 6-block radius is safe? And they say, oh, yes, of course, we can keep this area safe. We'll do it. And so even people who are skeptical say that they hope we keep trying because it would be a wonderful thing to not have to worry about any violence. Keep in mind that people who are involved in violence are still people. They are losing loved ones as well. They are burying people as well. They are worried as well. They are remorseful, believe it or not, right, when they are involved in violence. And so the idea that citizens of Baltimore, people who love Baltimore, care enough about each other's lives that we're going into neighborhoods and having conversations and making this commitment, looking in each other's eyes and humanizing one another instead of othering one another. It's that real recognizes real kind of thing that happens when you take this message to the street, because they recognize that you want to have an authentic conversation with them about their own power to have peace in this city.
This campaign began back in May.
In May, yes.
What spurred you to rally for a weekend of peace?
Well, I've heard about ceasefires my entire life, specifically about 2 years ago. Ogun, he's a Baltimore hip-hop godfather kind of guy, he came to me and said he was thinking of calling a ceasefire and he wanted to talk about doing it. And we kind of hit and missed each other back then. And then in May, my 19-year-old son said, Mommy, did you know that the murder rate is higher than it's ever been in Baltimore? And I said, I did not know that. And I got angry and I fussed about it. And then the next day, I realized that if I was that angry, then I should reach out to people who I knew wanted to do this. And everybody wants to do it. And that's the reason it's not just about me or just about the other 5 organizers. It is about Baltimore. It is about people who are hurting and traumatized and still have a lot of hope and strength to stand and say, this is something that we can do together.
What impact has violence had in your own life?
I've been going to funerals since I was 12 years old. When I was 12, one of my friends named Mike got shot around the corner. The gunshots woke me up out of my sleep. I heard him begging and crying, asking God not to let him die. I saw the ambulance come and take him away. When I came home from school the next day, I found out that he had passed away on his way to the hospital. And then in 2001, I had a brother who got shot and was dead on arrival. He survived, and he's now doing a lot of activism himself. Throughout high school, I lost friends to murder. In 2007, I did lose another brother to violence, my brother David. I've lost two cousins, two first cousins. So my aunt had three sons, and she's lost two of them to murder. And so, you know, it's just, I'm turning 45 this year. And I am at a space in my life that you're not supposed to be until, like, you're in your 80s, where you look around and a lot of people are gone. And that should be natural, you know, like that life has taken people. But this way of people being just snatched out of your life and constantly having T-shirts with people's faces on them and constantly going to corner vigils of candles and teddy bears and balloons on poles, that's not how it's supposed to be. And so the level of pain that I experience going to sometimes two funerals a year is not just me. It spurs all of us to figure out there must be something else that we can be doing. And a lot of us do peace work every day. And it can feel hopeless to still have this level of murder. But the truth of the matter is there is a lot more nonviolence happening than there is violence. But the violence is palpable. And so our strength to do things about it has to be just as palpable and just as strong. And this is what I love about Baltimore. We are an example right now of what happens when people decide together. We are going, not just that we can, we are going to do something about it. And people have been. And that's the only reason why I'm on your show right now, because people have decided we're going to do so much that the media is going to come to us to get this story.
This is On the Record on WIP. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Erica Bridgeford, one of the organizers behind Baltimore Ceasefire, a group calling for a weekend without murders. In your day job, you're director of training for Community Mediation Maryland, which promotes conflict resolution and community-based peacemaking. Do you think that the personal connection of this project, community members asking for a commitment to peace, will that make it more effective than similar pleas from the mayor, from the police commissioner?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the reasons why we made sure that we did not have anyone's logo, anyone's organization connected on any of the material. We knew that if it sounded like there's one person or one organization or one agency calling for this, a lot of people would not take it seriously. It would not have the same kind of credibility as if your cousin is asking and your grandmom is asking and your neighbor is asking and your homeboys are asking and the people you run with in the streets are saying, this is what we're going to do. That's what gives things credibility. And so we knew from the very beginning that if we want everybody to know, it has to belong to everybody.
Of course, it's sad that it is a lofty goal to go 48 hours in Baltimore with no one being killed.
72 hours, actually, yes.
But it is a lofty goal. And if someone is killed that weekend, how will you judge whether your effort was worth it?
Well, we've already deemed it worth it. We've already said it is successful, and it is because we're watching how impactful it is in Baltimore. When we sent out the press release and we were told by a lot of media, you know what, we'll maybe cover it on August 7th after we see what happened. It's impactful that now our phones are ringing off the hook every 5 minutes because people want this story. That means that Baltimore residents have already risen to the occasion. And so if someone gets killed that weekend, we believe that it is going to be an outcry that may be different than other kinds of outcries you've seen before, because people all over the world are watching Baltimore that weekend. People in Portugal and Russia and Asia and Britain are supporting this effort, sending money, talking about it, having us on their media. So everybody is watching and praying for Baltimore in hopes that nobody gets killed. So those families who lose someone that weekend, they're going to get the kind of support that is unbelievable. And as a homicide survivor, I know that it was communities of people rushing to our family when we got the news that my brother was murdered. It was that support that kept me on this side of sanity. And so the fact that if someone gets killed that weekend, those families are now going to be getting love and support from people all over the world, That's really important. And if just one person does not lose their life and does not experience killing someone because they heard this message and they took heed, they let it, that rumbling in their spirit, they let it settle and change their decision making, then it's been successful already.
After this weekend, how do you keep the momentum of this movement going? I mean, how do you summon hope when city residents have lived through so many deaths?
Yes, people have lived through so many deaths, and now people have done so much outreach and have done so much community building together just since May. And so we've already set up meetings for Ceasefire 365. That stuff is already in motion, and I'm really excited at just the fire that people have about continuing to work together in ways that I think we had been working in silos, you know, separate from one another in some ways. And now this is just a new opportunity for people to come together a lot and continue to do the work all year round.
Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Erica Bridgeford is Director of Training for Community Mediation Maryland and a key organizer of Baltimore Ceasefire, a call for the community to forestall murders from Friday through Sunday. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you've been with us. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.